Hi, good afternoon. I'm Harlan Rotblat. This talk was supposed to be given by the much more presentable Ben Goldstein, my colleague, but I will have to do my best to give justice to her work here. So this is going to seem a little bit like you're going to wonder, like, did I put my slides up instead of Dr. Katz's? Because a lot of the first ones are going to seem very similar, but it's a little different population, quite a different population, and somewhat different emphasis. Prevalence of rectal chlamydia and gonorrhea in females, but looking at multi-site testing at juvenile detention facilities. So by way of background, this is repetitive, I'll go through this quickly. CDC recommends urogenital CT screening for sexually active young women and rectal CT GC screening for men who have MSM, who have receptive anal sex. But there are no recommendations for rectal screening in women, even in high-risk populations like juvenile detention centers. In terms of our juvenile detention centers, we have one of the largest, if not the largest, juvenile justice system in the United States, 20,000 youth admitted every year, 20% of whom are female, and all the females who go through into the juvenile halls are tested for chlamydia and gonorrhea at intake, at the very least. In 2008, of those tested, 14.5% were CT positive and 3.6% were gonorrhea positive. So the way that this works at the juvenile halls, again, this is just by way of background to get to what we did, urine specimens are taken from everybody at admission, and then 2 to 7 days later, a physician takes a physical, at which time, currently and on current protocols, a cervical and a rectal specimen is also obtained. If the woman is menstruating during the physical, then those specimens are obtained somewhat later. 35% of the detainees are released before they get their physical, so they don't get those second tests, and then some greater proportion or additional proportion are don't get them because they're menstruating at the time of the physical. And then for those who are positive, we do attempt through case managers to contact and interview all of them for risk reduction counseling and partner services. So what we wanted to do with this analysis was we wanted to evaluate chlamydia and gonorrhea multi-site screening that's done at the juvenile halls in young women. First of all, as we saw with San Diego, to compare the prevalence across these sites of chlamydia and gonorrhea in the rectal, the cervical, and the urine specimens, no pharyngeal specimen. But also we wanted to determine the proportion of rectal-only positives. And in particular, what we're looking at, there's a lot of screening going on here, a lot of resources. We're going to see what we're really going to miss if we didn't do the rectal screening, for example. So what we did was we took all of the tests that were done in 2008 at all three sites, urine, cervical, and rectal, for the women who went through the juvenile detention centers. Those specimens are tested by the LA Public Health Laboratory. We matched the urine specimens done at intake to the cervical and rectal specimens done at the physical. And we excluded from the analysis, first of all, specimens that we couldn't match, but also cervical and rectal samples that were collected more than 14 days after the urine specimen. We felt that was too much time. And we also excluded cases that were treated for chlamydia and gonorrhea between the time of the urine specimen and the specimens taken later. So what did we find? Well, this won't be a big surprise to you after this session, but for chlamydia, we were able to match tests for 1,431 females, which is about 40% of those admitted during the 2008. We excluded additional 41 because they were treated between the time of the urine and the other two specimens. We excluded 97 because the intake specimen, the physical specimens, were conducted more than 2 weeks apart. That left us with 1,293 females to include in analysis. And what we found were of that 1,293, the overall chlamydia prevalence was 19.8%. So this is a very high risk population in juvenile halls. Looking across the sites, you see that urine prevalence was 15.5%, cervical prevalence was 16.1%, and the rectal prevalence was actually higher than either of the urogenital sites at 16.9%. Two-thirds of the women, in fact, were CT positive at all three sites, and I don't know if I can use the technical term, whopping 83% of urogenital, women who had one or both urogenital specimens positive were also rectal positive. And there were 13%, 33, of the women who were positive were rectal onlys. And you can see this in this Venn diagram. So the overlapping colors in the middle, those are the ones who are positive at a urogenital, one or more urogenital sites, but also rectally. You can see the 33 rectal only at the bottom, and the numbers at the top, the 10, the 14, and the 13, are the only urogenital positives who were not rectal positive. You can see the vast majority were rectal positive if they were also urogenital positive. For gonorrhea, we have very similar results, a little less pronounced in terms of the rectal positivity. We matched test for 1,445 women, again about 40% of all admittees. 42 specimens were excluded, 42 women were excluded because they were treated between the urine and the cervical and rectal specimens. 99 were excluded because the cervical and rectal specimens were collected more than 2 weeks after the urine. That left us with 1,304 to include an analysis of those 1,304. We had an overall gonorrhea prevalence of 5.2%. And again, very similar across the three sites, 4.1% for urine, 4.1% for cervical, and a little bit lower in this case, 3.8% for rectal. So half of all GC positives were positive at all three sites. More than two-thirds of those who were positive at one or more of the urogenital sites were also rectal positive. And 10% of, or 7, of the gonorrhea positives were rectal only positive. And here we see that in the Venn diagram. Again, with the 4, the 35, and the 3 in the middle, the overlapping colors being positive at one or more urogenital sites and rectally, the 7 rectal only is at the bottom, and the 4, the 11, and the 4 at the top are the urogenital one or more positives that are not rectal positive. You see, again, the majority have rectal positivity. So, I'm sorry, I think I went backwards. We also looked at the interviews that were conducted by our case managers when they did their follow-up to see if this pronounced rectal positivity, how that linked up with reported anal sex. And of the rectal onlys for chlamydia or gonorrhea, only 18% reported having anal sex, which is sort of in line with other reports of people are saying how much that they've had anal sex. But doesn't begin to explain all of the rectal positivity. And when we looked at women who were positive for one of the urogenital sites, urine or cervical, and not rectal positive, almost the same, I mean, 13% of them said that they had anal sex, which was not a significantly lower number than the 18%. So self-report in this case is not syncing up with the rectal positivity. So what do we make of this? Well, we found equivalent high prevalence at all three anatomic sites in both diseases. The majority of positives were positive at all three sites, in fact. And we would have missed more than 10% of chlamydia and gonorrhea positives, chlamydia or gonorrhea positives, if we had not done the rectal screening, which was a little different than what we had imagined. And once again, the history of anal sex did not appear to be associated with rectal positivity. It didn't match up with it. This study has a lot of limitations, one of which is that we had specimens for women, 25% of our women, that we couldn't match. So there were people who weren't around in juvenile hall for the cervical and rectal specimens, but there were also women who were, but we couldn't match the specimens with the urine for one reason or another. We didn't have access to clinical history, so we couldn't compare our results on the NAT tests with, say, clinical symptoms. There were limitations in the case manager histories we looked at in terms of reliability, in terms of how these were recorded or asked, and some lack of detail in terms of condom use, for example. And we didn't have any behavioral data to compare with for the negatives. In terms of sort of trying to understand these results, this slide is a little imprecise, so let me sort of bear with me as I try and walk through it with you. But first of all, what are we looking at when we're looking at this large amount of rectal positives? Are we looking at bacteria that are not infections? Are we looking at contaminated specimens because these are not collected with a speculum, so maybe as the swab is going in, it's picking up stuff from the nearby area, the perineum? Or are these actually true rectal specimens? And then these sub-bullets on the last bullet actually apply to the first bullet as well. Whether it's bacteria or true infection in there, how did it get there? Is it that everyone is having anal sex? That doesn't seem to sync up with any other data that we're looking at. Is there other sexual contact that's non-penetrative, but which is either, you know, causing transmission of bacterium to the area or infection? Is this an auto-inoculation? Is this coming from the vagina? This doesn't explain the rectal onlys, of course. This is coming from the vagina through dripping or wiping or some other contact like that. And for the rectal onlys, you have some of the same questions, but it's unclear if it's auto-inoculation. Does it mean that there was a false negative in the vagina, or it had been cleared, or some other explanation there? In terms of future directions, well, if we're not getting an explanation of self-reported anal sex to connect to these results, can we find any risk factors which help explain the rectal positives? We need a better understanding, of what we're looking at. What does a positive rectal test mean, since it's so ubiquitous? Is this contamination, or is this true infection? And if it is infection, what's the clinical significance? Are we looking at sequela if we don't catch it by doing rectal testing, for example? Are we looking at greater, you know, susceptibility to HIV? What's the public health significance if this is true infection and if we were not to catch it by doing rectal testing? What would there be extra disease transmission if we were not catching this disease? So we have a lot of these questions that are raised by these numbers. And the sort of more fundamental question is, if we are asking these questions at this point, what is the value of the test? That's not a rhetorical question. I think Dr. Katz's data and a paper by San Francisco recently suggested that you are going to be able to use rectal testing to actually increase your capture of people with bacteria or possibly with infection. But we don't really know what the tests are showing us at this level, so I think it's worth asking, how are we interpreting these tests to use them in a meaningful way, clinically and for public health? Again, my colleague Ben Goldstein was the one who did this analysis, and also contributing with Sarah Gary, Melina Budov, Ali Sterling, Geta Einalem, and Peter Kernt. And I will try to answer any questions you have to the best of my poor ability, but you would also do well to contact Ben Goldstein directly at the contact information show. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Harlan. Are there any questions?
Yes. The question is, are there known sequelae for rectal infections for chlamydia and gonorrhea? One issue is greater susceptibility to HIV infection if exposed, that we see in other ways. I think there are some, but does anybody else want to take a stab at that?
I don't think that there are any recognized, in terms of uncomplicated chlamydial infection, but certainly LGV may well cause scarring in the rectum. And that's and since you didn't differentiate between your isolates, positive tests with LGV and other chlamydia.
But I think that's one of the questions we have open. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, actually, that's a good summary. Thank you for that. I was kind of blanking when you asked that question, but certainly you'd have practice. And if it's a true infection, for gonorrhea in particular, then you could have all the other, you know, rare but significant gonorrhea issues. But that's one of the issues, is this true infection we're looking at. Thank you. Other questions?
I'd just like to ask, and perhaps Julie may have an opinion, but if you had taken vaginal swabs instead of cervical and the urine, what would the chances of, what are the chances of contamination? And you've asked the question in a way yourself. What are the chances of contamination of the rectum from an untreated chlamydial or gonococcal infection? Has anybody really looked at that in the past? Because, you know, we've known this for a long time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think also it's like in this setting where you have a substantial number of people who are not coming back, released before they get their physical anyway, we're doing urine intake because it's easy, and that way we get, it's the widest net we can catch easily. It's sort of like, that was one of the issues that was before us, so when you're talking about the dilemma, is like, what's the marginal benefit of using this extra time and resource in this kind of setting? Dr. Schechter was saying, I'll repeat, that we could collect the specimens in the setting now where we would be able to answer some of our questions by having a scoped specimen collected and collected high enough so that we're able to really, and then you're saying we would culture it? That you're saying? You're just getting that test, but from high up, so yeah, yeah. So what we're picking up is good for real infection, then we're going to say. Yeah, so we'd have a good indication of infection, getting a higher specimen. Any other questions? Oh, thank you very much.
That's it. Well, thank you very much indeed.